Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Is this on? I can't tell. Let's check. I think it is. Yeah, it is. Good afternoon. It's February 6th, 2018. This is Not Fake News on KVRX 91.7 at Austin. I'm your host, Anurag Singh. There's lots of news to cover this week. Top story today, of course, is the State of the Union, which was last week. We have a lot to say about that. Up next, there's the controversial Nunes memo, which is making the rounds at Capitol Hill. That was declassified last week. We'll talk about what that means for the Trump-Russia investigation. And the Supreme Court shuts down Pennsylvania Republicans with the decision that means Pennsylvania has to basically redraw their voting districts. So we'll talk about the implications of that with regards to the midterms coming up. And, of course, there's a lot of other things we want to talk about. Rex Tillerson was here at UT Austin, and there's a North Korea whole fiasco there. So lots of interesting things. With me, as always, is now this is a new thing we're having, is the legendary Wes Dotson. Wes, how are you?
Hey, listeners, this is Wes Dotson. I was in the studio last week. I am from the Texas Order, one of the political reviews, or the only political review, on campus. And I'm joined on Anurag Singh today here in the studio.
Yeah, so how was your weekend, Wes? Was it good?
It was pretty good, yeah. It was decent. I loathe the cold, and so this weather is killing me, literally. I mean that literally. Yeah, I like Texas because of the heat, not despite of it.
Yeah, it was pretty miserable weather, I would say. But one thing I was interested in knowing about is that you told me that you do Arabic now. You study Arabic, is that right?
Yeah, I'm second semester Arabic, and you know, a lot of people will ask like, oh, do you have any former exposure? No, none whatsoever. I hadn't even seen a letter of Arabic going in. And I just thought that, at first I thought, you know, ooh, I can take 12 hours of this or 18 hours of Spanish. that was my original thought, but I think getting into it, you know, it's a nice community, and it's a great language.
Yeah, it's an interesting, what I like about Arabic is, if I'm correct, it's read from right to left, right?
Yeah, it's a bit of a gear shift from English.
Yeah.
You know, you tend, as a right-hander, I got the privilege of never having ink smudges.
See, yeah, I'm left-handed, so that's why I like Arabic, because it's right to left.
Would love it.
Yeah.
So it's nice.
Anyway, so as always, we'll begin with reading some relevant headlines, I think. I always collate some getting them from Democracy Now. So one of the big headlines, of course, is global markets are tumbling this morning across Asia and Europe after the U.S. stock market went into basic free fall on Monday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged by nearly 1,600 points in the middle of the day, marking the biggest point decline in financial history. And then the U.S. market rallied slightly, but at the closing bell, the Dow Jones was still down by a historic 1,175 points. I mean, it was considered very alarming on Wall Street, but many financial experts have kind of anticipated this drop because the Dow has surged over the last year. The Treasury Secretary Mnuchin said that the White House is monitoring the situation, but they're not that concerned. What do you think the adjustments in regards to?
Just a little bit about the technical specifics. We got a job report on Friday of last week that said that we had added 200,000 jobs in January, which is actually the highest since 2009. And then the thing that's really important here was the 2.3% wage growth that we saw. And that's what people are thumbing as scaring investors. With wage growth often comes inflation, and inflation in general is okay because businesses can predict some rate of inflation, build that into their business plans, but unexpected inflation tends to be a problem, and so people were getting really kind of scared out of the market from that. And then with inflation becomes the Fed can start raising interest rates at a higher level. And there was a new Fed chair, Jerome Powell, was instated last week. And so people don't know what his way of approaching this is, and so that's what's scaring people. They're thinking interest rates are going to start raising, which also makes bonds a little bit more attractive. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the reason that people will start to flee the stock market and go towards bonds. But, you know, like a lot of people have been saying, this has probably been on the books for a few months now. I think right now there's no need to, you know,
panic,
run in fear.
Yeah, I think people who have, don't just start selling off your 401k yet. I mean, it's not that bad. I think, like you said, I would also attribute it to inflation, because with the tax plan, they're cutting taxes, and the jobs report, and how those kind of mean essentially that there'll be more money in the system, right?
Right.
More money injected. So yeah, I mean, it has been really strange. I think the stock market growth, it's been really, really abnormal. It's been like 26% over the past 3 years, which is very unexpected. So I think this is just different, and that's why people are a bit taken aback. But it's a normal adjustment.
It's a bit of an adjustment back to normal.
Yeah, but it'll be interesting to think about, because another headline that I wanted to discuss was that basically the Reuters is reporting that the Trump administration is planning to release their infrastructure plan on Monday. And there was a draft that was leaked, which shows a lot of, I mean, it kind of confirms what he said at the State of the Union, where he wanted to invest, I think, was $1.5 trillion into infrastructure. And it seems like this is one of the worst times to invest in infrastructure, if you ask me, because typically you don't want to take private sector jobs away from the economy. You only want to do that, like, you only want to have massive government investment during economic downturn. And I don't know why they're deciding to invest in infrastructure now. It seems like a problem.
Yeah, well, I think you have to separate that. And this is not a great economic time, but it's a fantastic political time for Trump to be spending this money on infrastructure. He really has decided that the way he's going to approach the 2028 midterms and helping the Republican Party is by putting the conversation on the footing of economics. And so part of what he's doing here is tangible, evidential things that can, you know, he can say, look, this is how we help the economy in this way. And so I think that's what we're seeing here. And I agree with you. It does seem like an odd economic time to be dumping a bunch of money into infrastructure. And we should note that $1.5 trillion, like, to our conception of money, is massive, unfathomable. But the state of the infrastructure in America is really bad, and $1.5 trillion is just not that much.
I think it gets a D-plus rating from the Civil Engineering Society. I forget what it was.
Yeah.
But, I've always said that I think that if he wanted to... pairing this with the tax plan, I think, is a bad idea, because... If first of all, when the tax plan was being covered, I thought, well, if you want to create jobs in the American economy and prevent, like, foreign investors, right? Because I think the tax plan, I think 35% of the gains from the tax plan go to foreign investors. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the infrastructure, you're creating jobs in America, and a lot of, American, it's helping the American economy. So I would think that would be one of the better things to do if you want to improve the economy. But obviously, the tax plan passed, and now this infrastructure thing's heading up there. What do you think Democrats are going to think? They're going to be open to this idea? Or?
Yeah, well, so, I mean, no, I don't think that this is going to be the next area of bipartisanship that we see. I think Democrats are going to want to wait and have this infrastructure spending. Obviously, Democrats are not anti-infrastructure spending by any measure, but they're going to want to wait and have this under their belt, not necessarily under the administration, but perhaps under, you know, if they take it back.
Yeah, after the midterms, I would expect.
But it does this in conjunction with the kind of economic, tumult of this past couple days, does provide the Democrats the opportunity to start gaining ground in the economic conversation and to start saying, you know, be increasingly skeptical of Trump's claims about creating growth and start to show how flimsy, that growth can be, or how artificial that growth can be. You know, it was speculative to begin with, the kind of anticipation of this tax plan. And so part of what the Democrats should be doing, and we'll see if they do, is to start saying, you know, take a second look about Trump's claims mm-hmm. on the economy, and they have the same opportunity to do this with the infrastructure plan.
Well, that's what, at least from what I'm seeing now, is that with regards to the stock market, right? Trump was touting the stock market, the rise of the stock market in his State of the Union, and he was bringing it up a lot. Obama never did that because, and I think one of the Obama advisors said, the reason we never use the stock market as a metric is because if you take claim for the rise, you have to take claim for the fall. And so a lot of the Democratic lawmakers, like you said, are now talking about these economic numbers and trying to push these out. And I think it's a good segue to talk about the State of the Union. Obviously, we had a lot of predictions. Some of them came true. Some of them aren't true.
Sure.
So why don't you give me your initial thoughts while I try to rummage for my notes, actually.
Yeah. Well, so part of what I had said going into the State of the Union that turned out to not be so accurate was I thought Trump was going to really back away from the wall. And we got an outlay of his immigration plan, and part of that was, he said, you know, building a wall, and he didn't qualify that as I thought he would. I thought he would, you know, really frame it more in border security and non-actual wall measures. We didn't get that, which I think is going to weaken the negotiating hand of the Republicans going into mm-hmm. next week. McConnell said if we get a stopgap spending measure by the end of the week, he's promised a vote on immigration next week. And so going into that, I don't think he's put the Republicans in a very strong position. Mm-hmm. We got the same stuff about, you know, chain migration that we've been hearing from the Republican Party for, you know, several months now.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, with regards to immigration, I think all that talk about bipartisanship was complete nonsense. I mean, he has, with regards to the State of the Union, like, he conflated the Dreamers with MS-13, right? He basically kind of painted this picture of, you know, illegal immigration as like MS-13 vile savages or whatever. And with regards to DACA, I think it's pretty gloomy because, I mean, we've just released just today, John Kelly, the chief of staff for White House, said he expects that Trump is, he doubts that he's going to extend the March 5th deadline for DACA. And I think that that's in line with this very rigid kind of immigration policy he's put forth. And another thing, you're talking about the wall. Mm-hmm. I completely forgot, and I only remembered it in the middle of the speech, that throughout the campaign, one of the biggest things that Trump was pushing for was that Mexico was going to pay for the wall. I completely forgot about that, and I think everyone else has forgotten about it because no one's mentioning that. Mexico was supposed to pay for this $25 billion wall, and now he's basically putting that on the taxpayer.
Yeah, I mean, most people in the campaign knew that that was never going to happen. In fact, we got several affirmations from Mexico that there was no way they were paying for the wall. I mean, it goes back to the idea that Trump voters took him seriously, but not literally, and that most of this is kind of, I mean, the term is dog whistling. This wall speaks to more of a kind of shibboleth, if you will, that allows people to say he's doing something about immigration. Whether that, you know, policy is effective is, you know, secondary to the idea that he's just doing something. And I think that's what actually is part of the problem, and why he's put the congressional Republicans in such a weak position, because there are actual immigration hawks in, you know, the Republican Congress, people who actually want to see the flow of immigration stop, and the wall's not going to do that. And so with the White House kind of holding out for this wall and Republican congressmen really wanting to do something substantive about immigration, you've got a misalignment of goals, and I think that's going to start to show next week when we get votes on immigration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like what you said because of regards to what Trump wants, which is really what I call it is all show, no substance, because that's what the State of the Union was, I think, because for a lot of these issues that he claimed he was going to attack during the campaign, no movement has happened. With the prescription drugs, the opioid crisis, that was one of the big things he was pushing for. All he's done in the past year is call it national emergency, hasn't done anything on that. With infrastructure, he says we're going to get $1 trillion for it. He didn't even say where that money's going to come from. I don't even know where we're standing on that issue. And with you know, Afghanistan and North Korea. Like, for example, he had the North Korean defector with the stilts. That made a very good moment for you know, rhetoric and for, like, the kabuki theater of it. But what is the strategy on North Korea? It looks like it's just so misaligned. I mean, and it just seems... And then also with... he said that he cares about Puerto Rico and Texas and all that stuff. Well, coming back to reality, one-third of Puerto Rico is still without power. Here in Texas, Houston, they still haven't gotten the federal aid for that. And so he's just living in this alternate reality where all the crises that he's self-induced have just been completely ignored. And that's what the State of the Union was to me, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, in the flip side of that coin, you know, we as a nation really tend to think that the government is responsible for any of the big headline news that we see, and so the ability for Trump to take responsibility for the growth in the economy and the growth in jobs and the rise in the stock market is tempered, you know, like you said, if you take the gains, you got to take the losses. It's not entirely true that Trump himself is responsible for the lack of aid. The bureaucracy is pretty slow. I mean, within Katrina, you know, we saw that aid was measured out over several months in the aftermath, and you know, we're a good ways out, but we're still you know, Houston's on like a 10-year rebuilding program.
Yeah.
So I don't think that we can pin it all on him, but it to your point, you know, we want to make sure we take all of his claims about the gains in the same vein that we take the claims about the losses. You know, if he's going to disavow responsibility for the situation in Puerto Rico and Houston, we should also wonder then, why is he taking claim for economic mm-hmm. growth? And I think that's the way to look at it.
I mean, yeah, I think that, you know, just an acknowledgement of these serious issues would be important, but instead he's... My issue is that him and the administration seem to just keep tooting their own horn, but really a lot of this, there's a lot of serious issues that need to be addressed that he hasn't addressed, that his government, that the administration hasn't really moved on. I mean, we talk about the economy, but there's a lot of serious, I mean, I think pretty serious issues with the economy that we still haven't confronted, with the child poverty rate in the U.S. and life expectancies like down compared to other developed nations. I have other stuff here with like the housing markets and health insurance. I mean, all these are really pressing things. And I mean, we do have a good economy right now. Unemployment's pretty low. And I think that, you know, what I was expecting from the State of the Union was kind of more prescriptive and more substantive talk, which I guess that's not what you can expect, because it is just rhetoric. It's just kabuki theater. I mean, the Democratic response, if we want to get to that, it was equally as vapid and rhetorical. I think it was just so, I honestly couldn't even, the Democratic response, I was sitting with my notebook, I was like, where's the policy? All I got was that they want a living wage.
Right. I mean, so to address the kind of optics of this, Joe Kennedy's response, I think, was misguided, to say the least. What you saw with that is they focused on the social issues, and they framed it in terms of both the strengths of the Democratic Party on social issues and the weaknesses of the Republican Party. But those ideas are already baked into what, you know, people have as a concept of the Republicans and the Democrats. So he hasn't gained any ground. I mean, to be fair, he hasn't lost any ground. You know, it's a good way of speaking to the base. But going into the midterms, the voters that are there in the middle are not as atomized about these social issues. And I think, you know, like I said earlier, this new economic tumult is going to be a good way, or should be a good way, for the Democrats to start making substantive gains on that kind of turf, is saying, let's be skeptical about Trump's claims on the economy, and let's look at how Democratic regulations can, or Democratic policies can start to give us a stock market that doesn't have all this ups and downs. And you know, coming from a small L libertarian place, I don't think that, you know, the government is the primary driver of economic trends. But the Democrats mm-hmm. do have substantive economic policies, and it's time for those to be out in the forefront, right there up against the Republican Party, and that's just not what we saw in the Democratic response. And I agree with you. There was no policy. It was mostly a call to the base, and it was a safe play, but not the right play.
They need to definitely rethink their strategy with the 2018 midterms coming up, because that, I think, was one of the issues with the 2016 election, was that the perception amongst the American electorate was that the Democrats were really, really good with the social issues, but they didn't address the serious economic concerns, I think, of a lot of people. And that's really imperative moving forward, because, like you said, Trump, he hasn't done well with regards to social issues. He hasn't done well with a lot of the crises, but he has some economic things some numbers he can tout. And so that's what he's going to be pushing for through the midterms. And so they need to be on that same playing field. I think we should move on to the Nunes memo, because that's obviously another serious thing that's been circling around Capitol Hill right now. Obviously, we're talking about the House Intelligence Committee, which is declassified this memo from the committee chair, Devin Nunes. The Nunes memo purports this to show that the FBI and the Justice Department abused their authority by placing the Trump campaign advisor, Carter Page, under surveillance in 2016 over his ties to Russia. They were trying to essentially say that this whole investigation is compromised because it stems from this, you know, Steele dossier, which was politically motivated, arguably. And just today, they've announced the House Intelligence Committee unanimously has voted to declassify a Democratic memo, which is supposed to refute that response. That is, President Trump has 5 days to decide whether or not to block that release. We'll see how that turns out. But what are your thoughts about the Nunes memo? I think that personally, it really kind of backfired on them. They were trying to say that the investigation was compromised. If anything, the memo validates the entire Russia investigation, because it shows that there was credible evidence to investigate Carter Page, and that the investigation preceded the Steele dossier. Yeah. What are your thoughts?
Well, so I think some technical points to make about this. You know, the underlying information that Nunes is referring to is all still classified. So he is kind of giving us a summary is almost too generous. I mean, there's so much contextual information missing from this memo that we're not able to actually make an informed opinion about the claims that he's purporting to make here. Towards the substance, what little there is of it, he is essentially attacking the sourcing of the Steele dossier as sympathetic towards Hillary Clinton, and that all of the bias that the Steele dossier has surrounding it means that it was not a valid justification for starting the Russia investigation, which is the claim he makes, but is actually, you know, in opposition to the facts. The FISA warrant at question here is with regards to Carter Page, a kind of former Trump campaign consultant who has spent some time in Moscow and has been under FISA warrant observation for quite some time in the past. But what we know now is that this is not the instigation of the Russia investigation, as Nunes is claiming. As you said, it predates this Steele dossier by a good bit. What we saw is the first kind of tricklings of this investigation come from when Australia tipped the FBI about George Papadopoulos. Mm-hmm. Purporting to have information from Russia on
Papadopoulos is one of Trump's another Trump campaign member.
Was in the midst of the kind of Manafort debacle and, mm-hmm. and pled guilty to lying to the FBI. So I mean, the claims here, as I said, we don't have enough information to substantiate the claims, but I think from what we know about the FBI and from what they've said, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of evidence here to support Nunes's claims. And we'll see what the Democratic memo says. the White House has till Friday to release it, but even if they choose to release it in some form, they've got the opportunity to redact it and really kind of tear apart the relevant information. I don't expect much. Schiff himself, Adam Schiff, the congressman on the House Intelligence Committee that is authoring the memo, is a bit of a bomb thrower. There's a lot of smoke here. I have yet to see any evidence of fire on either end. And I think it's just, you know, kabuki theater. It really is. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's just not much to this.
Yeah, I just wanted to remark, there was some technical issue. I think I was picking up the wrong mic, but we got you on.
All right, sounds good.
Yeah, so we can hear you now. But yeah, I agree with your view. I mean, 3 points. Number one, if the claim is that this is all stemmed from the poisonous steel dossier, mm-hmm. that's false, because we know that Papadopoulos, this preceded the that investigation in Papadopoulos preceded the steel dossier. Number two, even if we're arguing that the investigation is predicated on the steel dossier, who cares if Steele was politically motivated?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is, we were discussing before the show, there's a legal precedent for informants who, and people obviously have personal biases.
Right.
And this idea that just because Steele has political motivations means that all the information he's gathered is completely irrelevant is just totally false.
Mm-hmm.
And number three, this shows that multiple administrations and were interested in Carter Page, and that they kept coming back to the FISA court every 90 days. They have to renew the warrants,
right?
And so they're renewing this idea of probable cause. So it just I don't even understand what the logic was behind releasing this. If anything, it just shows that the Russia investigation is incredibly important.
Yeah, well, and this fits into the broader idea of, these people live and breathe politics. I mean, it is all they do. It consumes their world. And so they assume that because they can't separate their political bias from their ability to give relevant information, no one else can either. And so that's what the logic, if we're to call it that, behind this memo is that the FBI, the Steele dossier can't separate, Chris Steele cannot separate his political motivations from his ability to gather intelligence objectively. And we should note here that the Steele dossier is yet to be substantiated by any American mm-hmm. justice institution. It likely never will be.
But we know that Steele himself has sources, has been considered very credible. He has sources
yes.
within the Russian government. I mean, I don't know the specifics of the Steele dossier. There are some weird, very weird stuff about that. I'm not going to mention them
sure.
on the air. But yeah, it hasn't been substantiated, but we know that Steele is a very credible source with regards to intelligence.
Right, yeah. The MI5 does consider him a credible source. And I think what part of what we're seeing with Nunes's attack on it is the idea that the only credible institutions are American institutions, which is weird because he's in doing so undercutting an American institution.
Yeah.
So it's cognitively insignificant. I don't factor it into my opinion about the Russian investigation. And to be honest, I don't think other people should either.
But I do think that this memo is interesting because if you look at the names dropped,
mm-hmm.
You have Comey, you have McCabe, you have Yates. They're all gone.
Sure.
But I think the crosshairs are now on Rod Rosenstein, who is, of course, the deputy attorney general and who is in charge of the Russia investigation. And Trump was recently asked by journalists, would he fire Rod Rosenstein? And he said, and I quote, "You figure that one out for me." You can figure that one out. So, I mean, Rod Rosenstein, his job is in jeopardy here. And if he fires Rosenstein, I mean, there are talks of a constitutional crisis right there, because Rosenstein is in charge of running the Russian investigation, and he's basically the boss of Mueller.
Yeah, well, and it's important to note also that Rosenstein is the only person technically capable of firing Mueller. And so what would likely to result from a Rosenstein firing would be, like you said, a very serious crisis. But
you know, would be something akin to a Saturday Night Massacre. Yeah. Trump would have to just roll heads down the stairs of the Capitol until he finds somebody willing to fire Mueller, which is unlikely to happen. And we know from previous information that Trump did attempt to, in some way, shape, or form, fire Mueller. So, I think that the most likely thing to result from this Russia investigation is that Trump puts his foot in his mouth and lies to the FBI. He's on some rant about wanting to sit down and interview with Mueller. Yeah. His lawyers, of course, are saying that we do not want that to happen. Because Mueller's going to ask tough questions, and Trump's going to have to answer. And even if it's not under oath, you can't lie to the FBI. Yeah. It is, it's still legal. And so I think that is the most likely thing to occur.
I don't know where that falls in the timeline, though. Do you think that he would... I don't even know if he would consider firing Rosenstein right before the 2018 elections. I don't even know how it factors into the elections, but the midterms, because I don't know how the American public is on this Russia investigation, if they're even keeping informed on it, or if it's just us political junkies.
Yeah, well, on the issue of the American public, I don't think we see a lot of engagement with the kind of underlying facts about it, but we do see a lot of support for the investigation, as an independent investigation of itself. Mm-hmm. I think the last statistic I saw, and it's pretty dated, so take that into account, was like something like 79% support the idea of Mueller and this investigation. So attempts to interfere with it by the president are going to have serious repercussions. And just as a general note, I think it also speaks to more conservative fears of kind of assaulting institutions and assaulting justice institutions. So those people in Trump's base need to be kind of set aside because they operate on kind of different rules of political gravity. But the people that Trump needs to worry about and that are going to be operative in the 2018 midterms are people who would be very, very concerned if Trump were to try to take steps to interfere with this investigation.
Yeah. So because of that, I don't know if that's going to happen before the midterms, if anything concrete will happen, like him trying to make moves on Rosenstein.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that's looming over everyone's heads.
But, right.
I think this is a good time to talk about we could talk about the Tillerson speech at UT Austin. Mm-hmm. I think that was something that was interesting, and it speaks to a lot of the kinds of the issues I have with Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State. For those of you who don't know, Rex Tillerson was actually here at UT Austin last week. I think it was last Thursday, and he gave a speech. He's on this trip right now across Central America, Latin America,
mm-hmm.
And so I don't know why he started in UT Austin, but anyways. So,
yeah, well, Tillerson himself is a UT alumnus, so that's part of the reason, I guess, mm-hmm. That he is coming back here. He's on a bit of a kick with South America, or Latin America, I should say. And then after the speech, he had a conversation with Professor Will Inbeden, of the LBJ School, and that was actually pretty insightful. The students got to ask some questions. Professor Inbeden got to ask some questions.
Mm-hmm.
And my general impression of the speech was that Tillerson is in a bit of a tricky situation with Latin America. Trump does not present a good hand for Tillerson to play on Latin America. His political rhetoric and his kind of positioning towards Mexico and Puerto Rico do not really make him somebody very popular in Latin America. So Tillerson has to have that as the backdrop to his negotiations and his relationship with Latin American countries. And so he's really instead focusing on the kind of policies that he's going to be pursuing and talking about strengthening economic growth within those countries, which is safe territory for him, mm-hmm. for sure.
Yeah, I think it was, I mean, my primary concern with that speech was the the question about Venezuela and the whole situation. As we know, the Trump administration is not recognizing or legitimating the Maduro regime in Venezuela, which has been really kind of brutal, a brutal regime. And they've placed sanctions on Venezuela. And it seemed as if Tillerson was, I mean, the way that I took it, and a lot of the news aggregates took it, was that he was saying that there might be support for a coup in Venezuela.
Mm-hmm.
But, I don't think that that's something that's high on the agenda right now. I think, like you said, it was a very run-of-the-mill speech. I mean, that's what you expect from officials coming to colleges, and just they're not going to be throwing bombs out there. So yeah.
Well, and the order actually had one of our writers take a look at this.
Yeah.
And you know, I think support for a coup is maybe too strong a word for what Tillerson expressed. It was more of like a, hey, if it happens, that's okay with us. You know, he's got a place in Cuba to go to. He was a little bit flippant about it. But there was no sign that this is something that the American government is pursuing in any substantive way.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of more of a, if the Venezuelan military decides that things have gotten too far, you know, we will look at whichever new regime is under takes place and go from there. And like I said, he's also in a bit of a difficult situation rhetorically. There is the American government does not recognize the Maduro regime, and so it's almost impossible to say, like, we don't recognize your regime, but we want you to stick around. So the question there was a tough one for him. And I think that he should have probably just tried to shrug it aside. It was pretty unsafe territory at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting thing it's also a good segue into what I think about Rex Tillerson as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at this past year for him, it's certainly been a very, very tough year. I mean, one of the things I think that one analysis I read was that one of the biggest accomplishments of Rex Tillerson as Secretary of State is that he's still a Secretary of State despite the, I mean, he's had these back, like, miscommunication with the president with the North Korea thing. He was trying to talk to North Korea, but Trump was like, this is a waste of time. He called Trump a moron, and then there were other things like that. And I think there's been a lot of mixed thoughts about this. I mean, a lot of miscoordination with regards to the State Department and foreign policy. I mean, I wanted to discuss as well this new bombshell about the bloody nose strategy, which that is, I mean, that's something that I think we can just talk about. It's just so frightening, this whole thing. I mean, for those of you that don't know, why don't you just tell us the situation.
Yeah, so the Wall Street Journal reported that within the Trump administration, national security officials had really been talking about some type of proactive measure against North Korea to assure them that we as a nation are committed to a response to North Korean aggression. This has been termed the bloody nose. The kind of underlying logic here is that nuclear deterrence is based on the willingness of both sides to respond to aggression from either player, and so the idea is that the bloody nose, the technical specifics of it would be some type of military strike against a target in North Korea, whether that be a launch site or a military base. We don't know. But the idea would be that it's a reaffirmation of our commitment to respond to North Korea's aggression with force. Trump himself has publicly denied that this is his policy. But even the idea that this is being discussed in serious circles in the administration is really frightening. And I think Victor Cha, someone who was up for the South Korean ambassador position until he started to address this issue, is now no longer in the running for that position. So I think that does lend some credit to the idea that this is being addressed as a serious possibility for the administration. Mm-hmm. And in fact, he wrote an op-ed, saying and outlining the dangers of this.
So Victor Cha is actually where this information comes from, because he was an official in the Bush administration, mm-hmm. and he was in the running for, as you mentioned, the ambassador to South Korea. And he had gotten clearance from the White House. They had communicated to South Korea that this is the ambassador. And so what that indicates is that they were really pushing for Victor as
right.
the ambassador. But he recently just got shut out of the whole process because of this policy difference.
Yeah.
So I think it is a very legitimate... It is completely confirmed now that the Trump administration has been floating this idea of having this kind of preemptive strike on North Korea. And if you look at kind of the players in the Trump administration, Tillerson and Mattis, the defense secretary, and Tillerson, the secretary of state,
right.
are kind of less or more dovish on North Korea,
mm-hmm.
whereas H.R. McMaster, one of the head of the National Security Advisors, I think, he's pushing for this bloody nose strategy. I think the logic, like you said, is they think that North Korea... They think that they can attack the nuclear sites with North Korea and use just enough force so that North Korea will not reciprocate the attack, which is just... I don't even know what the logic behind that is. Yeah. The idea that you can... That Kim Jong-un won't retaliate is just... To me, it just seems extraordinarily short-sighted.
Yeah, and this is where we're lacking some of the specifics here. So to separate first strike into kind of two different categories, there's the idea of a first strike... as a means of ensuring that North Korea can't respond. So a first strike in that situation will look to take out all of the nuclear launch sites in North Korea, which...
We don't even know how many there are.
That's don't what, know how many where they...
Yeah.
And even one I was looking at earlier today, one that we do know where it is under a mountain. Like, North Korea is a very mountainous region. We don't know where all these sites are. And so that, as an idea, is really... pretty facile. There's no way that our first strike is going to take out the ability of North Korea to launch some form of nuclear counterattack. To get into the other kind of category is the posturing first strike, if you will, this bloody nose that people are floating is really more of an affirmation that we are willing to respond with direct military aggression to any kind of North Korean aggression. What is the underlying logic to that idea is that once North Korea develops nuclear capabilities, they will be undeterrable. Nothing we do can dissuade them from launching a strike. We have lost that capability. And then the second idea there is that they're going to be able to start selling those nuclear weapons to non-state actors, terrorist groups, what have you, and that would be the idea that we'd be trying to deter with this bloody nose. The problem with that logic here is, in one hand, you're assuming that North Korea is irrational, which means that after they've gotten nuclear capabilities, they couldn't be reasoned with to not
yes.
use those. And then on the second hand, you're thinking that they're rational, which means that they're going to see a first or a bloody nose strike as something that should
yeah.
deter them from getting... It's completely nonsensical.
Yeah. I mean, and Victor Cha mentioned this, that the idea that we should attack North Korea, I mean, one of the reasons that stems from is that it's better for to do a strike there and that Americans wouldn't be harmed,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
But Victor Cha mentions that, you know, there are at least 300,000 Americans in South Korea and Japan.
Yeah.
And, I mean, if we're only considering American lives and not South Korean and North Korean lives, for that matter. So you're putting a lot of lives in jeopardy, and this kind of... It would be if there was ever a battle between North Korea and the United States, it would be like something that we've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it is incredibly frightening.
Yeah, well, and part of the consideration to make is something called the escalation ladder. North Korea is actually relatively predictable when poked.
Yeah.
You know, South Korea shot up a North Korean ship. And killed one North Korean sailor. And about 4 months later, they sunk a South Korean warship. So they are more than willing to respond to aggression. And so while a first strike or this bloody nose strike may not result in a nuclear response. Yeah. It is almost certainly going to result in a direct aggression response from North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And Seoul, we've got to remember, is literally within artillery range of North Korea. And we have to take South Korean lives into consideration here. It is not, you know, anything we do in this region threatens American and South Korean lives. And we have to be more willing to focus on what is the best for our allies and our interests instead of Trump's idea of really just focusing on American interests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that's something that's looming over all our heads, and we'll just have to see how that goes. I want to take a quick break here, and then when we come back, we'll be talking about the SCOTUS decision regarding gerrymandering. That's very interesting.
Yep.
So we'll just take a quick break here. Stick around. And we're back with Not Fake News on 91.7 KVRX at Austin. I'm Anurag Singh, and with me is Wes Dodson. So one of the issues that we wanted to discuss was the recent gerrymandering case that was put, well, not the case, but the decision by the Supreme Court. So the Supreme Court was essentially offered this, by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, this the chance to consider this ruling. The Supreme Court of Pennsylvania ruled that the state's congressional map was unconstitutional, and it unconstitutionally favored Republicans and had to be redrawn. And so Justice Alito was brought forth before Justice Alito, and essentially the court has declined to take this up, which essentially means that Pennsylvania will have to redraw their districts, and that likely will help the Democrats going through towards the 2018 midterm elections. I think with regards to Pennsylvania, the number of registered Democrats outnumbers the number of registered Republicans, and the perception is that if they redraw the districts, I think the Democrats can pick up 3 House seats. That's according to 538. So this is kind of an example of, I mean, and the fact that the Supreme Court hasn't taken it up shows that they kind of said that the case was settled, and they kind of agreed with the Pennsylvania Supreme Court.
Yeah.
So, yeah, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, so part of the read on this is that we do have to remember that the Supreme Court ruling on this is essentially that they're kicking it back to the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. So this probably doesn't represent the biggest kind of leaps forward on gerrymandering as an issue as a whole. Gill v. Whitford is still up in front of the Supreme Court.
And that is, by the way.
Right, yeah. So that's a gerrymandering case from Wisconsin that is looking at, and oral arguments were heard. And it's really delving more into the issue of, do we have a standard for addressing gerrymandering? Mm-hmm. This case essentially is going to be help Pennsylvania Democrats redraw the districts. And I think it's important to note that it is, the decision here is restricted to its violation of Pennsylvania state constitution, whereas this Gill v. Whitford case is really looking more at how gerrymandering fits into federal law and the constitution as a whole. So while this is a good sign on the gerrymandering issue, it's not the kind of final decision, not the kind of Roe v. Wade of gerrymandering that we're going to hope to see in the future here.
But it does have, I think, very interesting implications with regards to the midterms going forward. In fact, there's a member of the orator, I think his name is Emil, who is very well versed on this issue. He was going to come in today, but he has a class, unfortunately. And in fact, I think I was informed that there was another Supreme Court case that they're considering with regards to Maryland. So in Maryland, the roles are reversed.
Right.
So in Maryland, the Democrats are more predominant in terms of the districts.
Yeah.
But Republicans basically alleged that it's unconstitutional there, and that violates, I think there's a First Amendment clause of free association is where a lot of this gerrymandering stuff comes from. And the Supreme Court, in a very surprised decision, said we're going to consider that case. And so that's something that's coming up before the elections. And I think it does have, it's interesting to think about how that whether we will have a Roe v. Wade with regards to gerrymandering. I had it explained to me by some, actually a government major from KVRX, over the weekend. He was not of sound mind, but it was at a party. But I think with gerrymandering, it's a different situation from something like Roe v. Wade, because different states draw their districts differently. And so it is, like you said, this is not a landmark case by any stretch of the imagination, but it is an important thing, I think, moving towards the 2018 election.
Yeah, well, so to your point, I think the closest thing we're going to get to a landmark case is something that recognizes a uniform standard that can be applied to assess gerrymandering. There are a couple of contenders. The biggest one is the kind of wasted votes measure, the idea that any votes that are not essential to winning would be wasted, and calculating the number of wasted votes in a given state is a good indicator of gerrymandering. What's also important here is that the Supreme Court is very explicit about providing motive in conjunction to that standard. So Republican arguments against this are typically that, like, political geography and self-sorting account for most of gerrymandering. And that tends to fall a little bit facile or a little bit short when you have to also prove motive. You have to prove the kind of underlying conspiracy, if you will, surrounding the gerrymandering. And so I think that's a really helpful standard. That's going to be something that plays big here. Obviously, motive was proved in the Pennsylvania case, and we will see in Maryland. But Justice Kennedy, in his previous decisions, that essentially said that the court is not going to adjudicate gerrymandering until we have a uniform standard,
sure, yeah,
has really opened the door for that landmark decision of saying, this is what we recognize as something that if you bring it before the court and can prove via this standard that there is partisan gerrymandering going on, we will adjudicate that and require these districts to be redrawn. And this is a big issue. The census is coming up in 2020, and so, you know, draftsmen will be headed to the table again. And it's something that needs to be settled by then, I think, because it's a self-perpetuating system.
Yeah.
People in power then get to draw the maps again.
I think it has serious consequences with regards to if we want to get third parties involved.
Yeah.
If we want to talk about, like you said, self-perpetuating, you know, congressmen who keep getting elected unopposed,
right,
because of these districts that are drawn in such a way so that, you know, voters really don't have the decision is already made, kind of. And I think it's one of those issues that I think obscure, and a lot of people don't really recognize. One thing I'm very comforted by, I guess, is that, you know, for all the criticism of the Supreme Court about how divided it is now, they are, I think, surprisingly, I thought, because the Supreme Court is, you know, 5-4 Republican,
right,
leaning, I thought they would pick up this case, and I thought that they would be more, you know, adamant, more, I guess, activist with regards to the Republicans, like, you know, pushing for the Republicans, but they're not. They're you know, they have a very high standard, I think, which is very good to hear.
Yeah, well, I think part of that links back to the idea of motive, like we said. If you delve into the history of gerrymanders, there's just some crazy stuff going on, you know, backdoor, you know, maps that get released and then voted on within hours before people, you know, Democrats in a state will get like one chance to look at the map and say, hey, and then they get kicked out of the door, and, you know.
And that happens the opposite direction,
of
too.
Of course, right, yeah. It should be said that the current state of gerrymandering really draws back to 2010 with the landslide nationwide Republican surge in state legislatures. And so typically you will see that it favors Republicans.
Right now, yes.
Right now. But it's on both sides.
Yeah.
Gerrymandering is an age-old tradition in America. It's like hot dogs on 4th of July. It's just endemic to the political system. But the changes that we've seen is that the methods of determining the most efficient way of packing or cracking a district have, you know, come leaps and bounds, and so the gerrymandering can just be that much more effective. And that's why it needs to get settled. It's an issue that is pressing and actually going to continue unless we do something about it.
Yeah, I think, and it is one of those issues that I don't know how, because it, like you said, demographics change, voter systems change,
yeah.
And so it's something that we'll have to think about going forward.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, I think we're getting towards the later half of it. We have 4 minutes left, so I mean, there's a lot of issues that we've been talking about here. I think it'd be interesting to see where that comes out. With regards to the order, I think you're writing that new the Super Bowl article, right?
I've been hearing
about that. We haven't really talked about the Super Bowl, but I don't know if you watched it.
Yeah, well, I caught bits and pieces of it. I'm not a sports fan myself. But one thing I was interested about is how the pervasiveness of, or the growing awareness of CTE and the head trauma effects of NFL players, how that changes the nature of the game for the viewers.
Sure.
So, you know, the Rome-America comparisons abound throughout society. So I really kind of tried to put it in gladiatorial dressings. You know, we as an Enlightenment society tend to think that, you know, we go and watch games for the, like, values and honors on display. But the reality is sometimes we just like to see people get hit.
Yeah.
And we should be honest about that, and we should be honest about the effects that that has on the players. And if they're going to, you know, be willing to subject themselves to it, you know, I don't have a personal problem, but we need to really focus and say, look, sometimes we like to see people get hit, and that's okay if they're willing to accept it, you know, as long as it's voluntary. But I really tried to make the, like, you know, gladiator NFL football player comparison. I was just having some fun with it.
Yeah, well, I'll be interested in seeing how that article comes out. You can find that on the Texas Orator, mm-hmm. the website texasorator.com. Thanks very much, Wes, for joining me for today's hour. Shout-outs to Wes, anyone from the Texas Orator, Emil. Sorry you couldn't make it. My mom's still a bit sick, so I hope she gets better. Mm-hmm. And... Well, there's someone who's listening right now. She knows who she is. Thanks for listening very much. Yeah. So, as always, I wanted to thanks, Wes. And you have anything else to say before we go?
Yeah, well, you know, if you can dodge a wrench, you can dodge the flu. Please, 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 if you're sick, don't be coming to class.
Yes.
Yeah, I was sitting in front of somebody who was just coughing up a storm today in macro econ. And, you know, you can take the few days off.
Yeah. Well, stay safe, everyone. Stay safe and stay dry. Stay warm, too. It's kind of cold right now.
It's chilly.
All right. See you, everyone.
All right. Have a good one.
Yeah.